From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Protests against police violence were largely peaceful across the country last night. We'll hear from a director of a police union in Los Angeles in just a few moments.
But first, to a member of President Trump's cabinet. Earlier today, I spoke with President Trump's housing secretary, Ben Carson. Here is part of our conversation. Well, I want to first ask you, as the only African-American in President Trump's cabinet, what have the last several days been like for you?
Well, I think not only as an African-American, but as an American, period. You know, seeing what happened in Minneapolis is horrifying. And, you know, I, like everyone else, want to see justice here. You know, I'm glad the Justice Department is looking into it. I hope there will be some rapidity with what goes on, because I think people are very impatient. This is very clear cut. It's seen right there on the screen across the world what happened. So it's going to be pretty hard to excuse that, quite frankly. So I am very disappointed with the fact that people have used this as an excuse to vandalize and tear up the neighborhoods of the people who are so vulnerable and are least able to afford such things. And, you know, I understand the anger and the wrath, but I do not understand why they can't see that they're hurting the very people they purport to be standing for.
Well, many of the protesters believe that that is a distraction from the main movement that is going on. Most of the people who've been out in the streets have been peaceful protesters, and that focusing on the few who have been vandalizing takes away from the larger message of systemic racism that people are protesting against.
Yeah, but unfortunately, though they may not be the majority, they are wreaking havoc on people, and we have to stop that from happening. Do we have to look at maybe this as an opportunity to engage more in the discussions about racism and unfairness that occurs? I think we would be smart to take advantage of this time period to do that.
Well, what did you think of the president the other day using force to clear peaceful protesters from in front of the White House so he could cross the street and pose for pictures in front of St. John's Church with a Bible? The Episcopal Bishop of Washington said it was an outrage. As a person of deep faith yourself, how did you feel about it?
Well, again, the majority of the people there were probably peaceful protesters, but as I'm sure you probably have heard by now, there were those who were throwing bottles of frozen water, pipes were hidden along a pathway, and bricks to be utilized. And all of those people were told by loudspeaker, starting at 6:30, to clear the area. Some of the peaceful ones did clear the area. Some of them refused to clear the area. And if you're going to have the president walking through that area, it needs to be cleared. It was said that tear gas was used. It was not. It was pepper balls and smoke canisters.
Well, the chemicals that were used are commonly referred to as tear gas.
But they're not tear gas. And here's my point that I try to make on all these situations. We spend so much time getting into our respective corners and criticizing each other and fighting each other. When will come a time when we can actually use these opportunities to bring light? Somebody is going to have to begin to emphasize those very things that made such a dramatic improvement in our society, and not revert back to, you know, tribalism and hatred.
Well, would you say that to the president as well, who has, you wouldn't have to look very, well, have you said that to him?
I say that to everybody. And, you know, the president and I have many conversations. I do not quite understand why so many people think he's hateful when you look at the things that he's done over the course of his life. I don't understand it.
Well, what about when he said just the other day, when the looting starts, the shooting starts, which is a direct quote from a police chief, a racist police chief back in the 60s. Isn't that seen as hateful to you?
Well, that was borne out. And look at the people who, in fact, have been shot. Now, when that hateful official said that years ago, he was talking about something completely different.
Part of my conversation with Housing Secretary Ben Carson. You can hear more of it elsewhere in the show or at hereandnow.org.
On the protest, let's go now to Los Angeles, where police have arrested more than 2,500 people since the demonstrations began last week. After clashes with police in previous days, protests last night were relatively peaceful. And Robert Harris joins us via Skype. He's director of the Los Angeles Police Protective League, which represents officers in the LAPD. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And Robert, I want to first start by asking you about a comment from the LA police chief. In talking about looters and violent protesters, Chief Michael Moore said, George Floyd's death is, quote, on their hands as much as it is those officers. He has since apologized for those statements. But when people hear the head of the police of a major city casually put looting on the same level as a police officer pressing his knee on a man's neck, what does this say about how the LAPD officers view the people they're in charge of protecting?
I think it demonstrates that our chief has been burning the candle at both ends. Clearly, that is not what our chief meant to communicate. He's been doing nonstop interviews. He has exercised some of the best leadership I've seen of a chief in Los Angeles. He's been on the ground. He's been having dialogue. So look, I think we should cut the chief a little bit of grace in the fact that he's tired. And so he made a mistake. He made a misquote. Even the mayor of Los Angeles has recognized that. And I think instead of judging him on some words that he didn't communicate as effectively as he wanted to, I think we should judge him on his actions.
Well, on that topic of grace, I understand what you're saying about the police chief's words. But going out on the street, LA protesters have described police actually escalating violence. And we're actually seeing those images. Police officers spraying tear gas directly into people's eyes who are standing peacefully or laying on the ground, shooting rubber bullets into crowds. We're not just talking about a handful of police officers, and I'm talking about nationwide now. People are out there protesting because of a growing sentiment that this is bigger than a few bad officers. It's the system. What is your response to that?
I think anytime that we speak in broad generalities, I think we do a disservice to the solutions that we are trying to come to. Appropriately, the media has done a good job differentiating peaceful protesters from the looters, the vandals, and the criminals. I also think that we should be differentiating the men and women who wear law enforcement uniforms from those individuals who act outside the lines of what our profession demands or what the public expects. What's getting lost right now is the fact that nearly everybody has come to the agreement that what we saw in Minneapolis was an injustice. You've seen police leadership come out and condemn those actions. So when we talk about how law enforcement responds to the protests themselves, when those protests are conducted in a peaceful manner, like last night here in Los Angeles, you see that there are no incidences where the law enforcement needs to step in and take control of the situation. Unfortunately, there is an element that is either opportunistic or is organized in their anarchy, and they create chaos. And once they begin to create that chaos and hurl rocks and bottles at our officers and cinder blocks, then it's up to our officers to try and take control of one of the most chaotic environments that you can put a police officer in.
Almost three decades ago, police clashed with protesters in your city during the Rodney King riots. You were not a police officer at the time. What are the lessons learned in how officers now approach policing in this moment we're in?
That's a great question. The LAPD, we are at the forefront and have been now for decades as a result of looking at mistakes made back then and how can we relate to our communities better. We've seen civilian oversight, better transparency when it comes to reporting things like end-of-year use of force statistics to the community. We have had better discipline measures put in place. So a lot has changed since 1992. And when everybody is in this emotional state, it's hard to have conversations about how far have we really moved from then to now. And if the shared goal is to move further, then we can do that. But we can't do that until some of these emotions start to become tempered with some reason and some respect and some understanding, because that's when the discussion happens and that's when the problem solving happens.
Robert Harris is director of the Los Angeles Police Protective League and also a police officer. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
It feels like nothing in the news these days makes any sense. So Hassan Minhaj turned to his father and his faith for answers.
He said, don't worry about the number of questions. Just worry about which questions become more clear and solidified.
Comedian Hassan Minhaj on how his spirituality is getting him through. Listen and subscribe to It's Been a Minute from NPR.
There's so much happening in the world with COVID-19 and the uncertainties around states reopening and now nationwide protests against police brutality. It's a lot to grasp as an adult, even more so for children. So how can parents recognize and address children's stresses and anxieties about it all? To talk about this, I'm joined by Corinne Edwards, a therapist specializing in working with children who experience trauma. Welcome.
Thank you, Tanya.
I can imagine this is all age dependent, but can you talk about some signs of trauma in children specifically as it relates to what's happening in the world around us? What are the signs that we should be looking for?
So I think when we think about symptoms of stress for children or distress or even trauma, we think about them on a continuum. So I think many parents can relate to seeing symptoms of distress in their children, where it may be, for example, for younger children, seeing regressive type behaviors like more whining, more clinginess, disrupted sleep, which moves into more middle of the continuum. And then when we think of more trauma type symptoms, we're thinking about things like bedwetting, toileting issues. For teenagers, it might be excessive isolation beyond what we think of as the norm for teenagers. Expressions of hopelessness, expanded fears. So children projecting their fears, for example, at nighttime and being more afraid to go to sleep at night. So I think you're right that it's age specific, but the theme being regressive type behaviors and then an expansion and an intensifying of disruptive feelings.
Yeah. I want to talk with you a little bit more about how parents can help mitigate those fears and lessen that stress with children during this time. But I want to get to some questions that we have from some of the children in our lives about how they're processing the world around them. And our first one comes from 11-year-old Logan in San Diego about his fears of returning to school in the age of COVID-19.
Well, if they do open schools, like I would be excited, but like, oh, is everyone going to get sick or something? Because I don't want like everyone to die.
How do you reassure a child like Logan about his fears? He's hearing so much information and really what he might encounter in the future.
Yeah, and so I think that what's so unique about the situation that we're in with COVID-19 is that we as parents are sharing these fears with our children. That oftentimes when our children are experiencing fears or distress, we're able to console them and give them perspective. And so it's hard to be going through it at the same time as our children. And I think what's so difficult with the pandemic is the fact that there is such unpredictability and it can be incredibly overwhelming. But what the tool that parents have that they can utilize and is so accessible is their ability to connect with their child. And so what makes stress tolerable for children is having an adult to connect with and buffer from the stress. So a child just being heard and validated in their fears does an incredible amount to make that stress tolerable. And for them to receive messages of safety from their parents that they're not alone, that they're heard, and that we're going to get through this together.
Our next question comes from 14-year-old Isabel, and she's thinking about her new reality of homeschooling. Let's listen.
I think it's going to be weird And I think it's going to feel weird to, like, meet new people and the new teachers online. How do you transition from an old environment to a new one when new people and new faces and interact with this lockdown and COVID-19?
And what's really interesting about this, Corinne, is that Isabel is entering high school. So she's been thinking about this moment in her life for so long, going to a new school, meeting new teachers, meeting new friends. But there's a potential that this might all happen online for her in the fall. What are some tools that she and her parents can actually impart to help her navigate this new experience?
Yeah, I think she so nicely expressed what so many have been facing is how to deal with this new version of kind of virtually interacting with the world. And so one of the things that we'd need to reframe for her and for other children with these same concerns is that what we previously viewed as impersonal, right, that this virtual connection would seem so impersonal, may now be what we have to access to make it personal. And so I think that her parents would be able to reassure her that as hard as this is and how, as strange of an adjustment it is, as it is for all of us, it's what we have right now. And we need to start finding ways to get adjusted and more comfortable with this way of interacting. And so, for example, they might have her start increasing some virtual connections with her friends to get more comfortable with herself on the computer, just to, you know, get past the glitches and how to work the computer so that it's in more of a flow, so that that way she can be focused on more of the actual connection piece of the online schooling.
Yeah. And kids are so resilient. You know, they're more resilient many times than adults, nimble in change.
Mm-hmm. And I think as parents, so often the kind of gut reaction is to prevent the stress and make sure and avoid it and make sure your child doesn't experience any of it. But what we know is that how resilience is built in the brain is through exposure to stress, which we can call a rupture, but the repair after that exposure or after that rupture. Mm. So for parents, they can kind of assuage their own anxiety by knowing that, yes, this is hard for your child, but your child learning these skills to cope with this is what's going to make them more resilient.
Our next one is a comment, which actually comes from my son, Hudson, who's 7. He's been talking a lot about his eagerness to get back to normal, to do all of the fun things he used to love to do, like going to the grocery store with us. Let's listen.
Well, what I miss is having to go into the store with my parents, and they're always like, Hudson, stay in the car. Why can't I just come with them? And I also miss school because, like, you know, it's more fun at school because, like, lunch is kind of boring because lunch at school, you, like, get to talk with your friends and we can't have recess at home.
What's really interesting about a child Hudson's age is that they aren't technologically savvy in the way of being able to build connections on their own with their friends and build that new sense of normalcy while also having the connectedness and the social part of school. What are some of your thoughts for how to navigate this with your younger children?
Yeah, and I love how beautifully he highlighted what is important to children in his developmental stage, that recess where you're moving your body while also still socially engaging with your friends is so important for their little bodies and their nervous systems and their brain development. And it is hard to have those kind of Zoom meetings match that for them. They aren't as reliant on their social system in terms of their peers for their identity. So, like, for example, teens really need their peers as part of their identity. But for young children, parents can fill that void for them. So parents taking some of that time to play with their child, to engage in some of that movement while socially engaging. So, like, I know a lot of parents have been walking more with their kids or taking a bike ride or going outside and just even throwing a ball for a little bit. So mimicking a little bit of what they're lacking in their life will go a very far way for younger children.
There are also these larger fears for older children, like my 13-year-old daughter, who now has the agency to look up the news for herself. And she's reading a lot of stuff on social media about the death of George Floyd, the protests that are happening throughout the country. She has expressed fears about walking the dog in the evening, that she might get shot. It's horrifying to hear your children express these fears, but it's also reality. What's your advice to parents to help their children navigate these types of issues?
So as difficult as this time period is, it's also a chance to teach our children about how we want to consume the news and how we want to access social media. And so what is going to be the line between accessing information that you need, accessing social media to feel somewhat connected to what's happening around our country and around the world, but not doing it to the degree where it's going to move you outside your window of tolerance of distress, or where it's going to put you in a place where you feel so hopeless and powerless and shut down and numb. And so, for example, for your daughter, that would be a personal decision, and that would be something that you would be discussing with her. And the body is an incredible anchor for safety. So when does she start to feel it in her body that she's starting to reach her max of the news or social media? And it can give us this false sense of control, right? That if I can get enough information, then I would have enough control and be able to predict more in this time of uncertainty. But I think, again, it comes back to this idea of connecting with our children so that we can start having these conversations and not leaping into this role of telling them not to worry about it, or it's not a big deal, or it won't affect them, but hearing and validating their feelings and then collaborating with them on the support that they need so that they feel seen and heard, and then helping them come up with ideas of what is, so for teenagers especially, what would help increase feelings of safety? What would help decrease feelings of powerlessness?
That's Corinne Edwards. She's a therapist specializing in trauma. This is great advice. Thank you so much, Corinne.
Thank you, Tanya.
In Richmond, Virginia, more than 70% of the people who've died after contracting COVID-19 are Black. Racial health disparities in that city are nothing new. The 1918 flu pandemic also took its toll on Richmond's Black population, who were left to fend for themselves. Ben Pavier from member station VPM has more.
On October 12, 1918, Maggie Walker, the first African-American woman to charter a bank and a leader in Richmond's Black community, was interrupted from her work. Agena Rogers, who heads the Maggie Walker National Historic Site, reads from Walker's notes on what happened next.
A call came over the telephone from Governor Davis relative to the suffering of our people from influenza at the John Marshall Emergency Hospital.
Authorities converted a school in downtown Richmond into a makeshift hospital, but the facility was soon overwhelmed and Black patients forced into the basement. Governor Westmoreland Davis needed Walker's help to blunt the pandemic.
By the first week or two in October, it's raging through and sometimes taking out entire families.
So Walker opened an emergency hospital for Black patients at a neighborhood school.
The African American community was left on its own.
Dr. Vanessa Gamble is a professor of medical humanities at George Washington University. She studied the effects of the 1918 pandemic on African Americans, and she says medicine has always been inseparable from structural racism.
There was a time in this country, if your skin was Black, you could not be admitted to a hospital, even if you were bleeding in active labor or that you were in extreme distress.
Richmond's Black medical community was growing when the pandemic hit. The emergency hospital was led by Dr. William Henry Hughes, a surgeon who trained in London and Paris before returning to Richmond. In many cities, Black doctors treated Black and white patients during the pandemic. African-American women entered the Army Nurse Corps for the first time.
They thought that there would be more benefits and more opportunities, or even that their efforts would be acknowledged, and none of that really happened.
In Richmond, the Black medical staff earned praise from Governor Davis. But to the segregationist governor, the hospital's success was proof that Jim Crow was working, that African Americans could serve themselves, in his words, without any mixing.
The influenza epidemic did not wipe out or alter segregation in medicine at all.
In fact, it wasn't until 1965 that Richmond's largest hospital formally desegregated. Today, health outcomes can be drastically different for white and black patients. There's around a 20-year difference in life expectancies between Richmond's mostly black Gilpin Court and mostly white Westover Hills. There's a similar pattern in many U.S. cities. Stephen Wolf is a professor focusing on health equity at Virginia Commonwealth University.
What's happening with the pandemic is a new example of an old problem.
The Commonwealth Institute think tank estimates 40% of Virginia's frontline workers in the coronavirus pandemic are people of color. Wolf says these populations have been marginalized for generations, sidelined from good jobs, housing, and education. Now Wolf says he wonders if CEOs and policymakers see these workers as expendable.
Because we're living at a time where there's people starving for jobs, so if those workers get sick or die, they can be replaced.
Wolf's research suggests economic conditions, like access to food and housing, are more important to a person's health than the health care they receive. If that inequity isn't fixed, Wolf says, the country will be back where it started when the next pandemic hits. For Here and Now, I'm Ben Pavier.
We're hearing from a number of voices about the protests going on in American cities, and our next voice is a familiar one. A.C. Wharton was the mayor of Memphis, Tennessee from 2009 to 2015. He's joined us many times over the years to make sense of things. Mayor Wharton, welcome back.
It's great to be back, Jeremy.
Well, and as you look around the country at what has been going on for a week now, what are your thoughts on the protests, the movement, and the pushback from many, including the President of the United States?
Well, I think perhaps this movement is going to be cathartic. We thought we had purged our nation's soul of all of the things that are having the scabs pulled off of them now, but quite frankly, we really had not gotten down to what we really needed to do. It's rough now, but I do believe that in the end it's going to be quite cathartic, and I think we'll be stronger with respect to the pushback from the president. It's tragic, damaging, not merely to him. When presidents, not only this president, but presidents in general, will say so many times, it's not about me, it's about the office. Well, the things we've seen here lately certainly are not becoming of the office. I mean, we are the paragon. We are that, you've heard, the city on the hill. We're the nation on the hill to which all other countries look. So it's tragic, but I do believe that this is that reckoning that we have so long needed, particularly coming along with the pandemic.
How would you compare the energy that this movement has right now to what happened in the late 60s, both before and after the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr.?
It's almost the same. And I guess this is the beauty of it. There is no one leader. And we're being led by a generation of youth. They are adopting what we've always told them, be the change that you want to see. One thing that's different about this is it's worldwide. This is one of the few times that I've seen a generation of youth around the world take up the same cause. It does compare, except I think it's much younger. And obviously, they're much better connected because of the technologies that they now have that we did not have back then.
Well, what would be a mark of success from what is going on now? I would imagine it's a lot more than just charges against the officers who were involved in the killing of George Floyd.
Oh, yes. The officer who has been charged, that's really just a tool, a vessel, if you will. The Minnesota Human Rights Commission is not coming in to investigate the chief or investigate the promotional testing and training procedures. They're coming in to investigate the institution. And I think that's what we need to do, that kind of soul searching across the nation. Don't investigate bad offices. Investigate the institution.
This is happening at the same time that we are in the middle of an historic pandemic, which has killed at least 106,000 people in the United States. And we know that African Americans have been hit disproportionately hard in this, almost three times the death rate of white Americans. What are your thoughts on that situation and how the country has been responding to that and how long it's going to take to get control over the coronavirus?
The death rate is exposing something that has been endemic deep down within the fiber of our governments, our policies in general across the nation. That is that black lives, when it comes to health, simply have not mattered. How do we go forward? Not merely recognize those disparities, but come up with concerted, laser-focused efforts to let's do something about diabetes, let's do something about COPD, let's do something about obesity, all of these things, because that's what contributes to the disparity in the death rates between blacks and whites.
Now, Mayor Wharton, you and I met about 10 years ago in Memphis when I was doing some reporting on the effects of the Great Recession. Given your experience with that, and as you look at what we're staring at right now economically, what are you expecting this downturn to be like? How long do you think it will last?
Oh, it's going to last tragically. When the masses go back to work, there's still going to be those individuals, black and brown folks, urban folks, who even though this recovery comes, it'll be a long, long time when they see it. The demographics of Memphis, you find those in Detroit, Birmingham, Montgomery. So those are the areas that it's going to take a long, long time. The barbershops do much more than cut hair. They anchor that block that they're in. The corner store that closed anchored that neighborhood where it was. We need two recoveries. There's the economic recovery, but there's the neighborhood recoveries that's going to take a long, long time. Yes, there will be a recovery. I would say 12 to 14 months. Keep in mind, in addition to the pandemic, we've got trade wars going on. We've got tariffs. So even when the United States gets back to cranking, we don't know what's going to be going on in Mexico. We don't know what's going to be going on in China. And the market, as you know, it follows the fear. So it will be a long time when we dispel all of those fears. Long time before folks go out and buy cars because they don't know if we're truly out of this.
How are you doing in general, just with all this stuff?
I'm doing well. I've managed to maintain my health. 75 years old. My wife and I are back in the gym at least 3 days a week now. Let me knock on wood somewhere. So I just feel so fortunate, so blessed. I drove to work this morning, and they have to have police cars to block off four or five blocks right in Midtown Memphis because there's a church that's giving away food baskets. And I looked at the cars, and I didn't get into anything stereotypical, saying, oh, they got a good car. They got no business in that line. They must be cheating. No, it hit me a different way. I just thought they were probably working a 40-hour job 3 months ago. And they've lined up out here just like everybody else. And I saw that, and I'm riding along with my almost $3 cup of coffee, and I say, God, why didn't I give that $3 to them? I really have no complaints. I've got 8 grandkids. I've got one that was born in November. I have touched him one time. So if you were to say, AC, are you down about anything? It would be that one thing there. That's just how this whole situation has truly impacted us. I think America's spirit is suffering. I know my spirit is down. I'm still encouraged, but things like that really hurt. And I'm just one person out of 320 million plus Americans.
That is A.C. Wharton, the former mayor of Memphis, Tennessee. Thank you so much, as always. It's great to hear you and great to talk with you.
Jerry, it's been a pleasure. Take care.
The College Board announced this week it's scrapping plans for a digital take-at-home SAT test, citing concerns that many students may not have access to reliable internet needed to complete that 3-hour test. This comes as the University of California system, which includes UCLA and UC Berkeley, voted last month to stop using the tests completely over the next 5 years. For more on what this means, we're joined now by Scott Jasek, editor and co-founder of Inside Higher Ed. Welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Yes. So let's talk a little bit about this decision to phase out the SAT and ACT. It's kind of been a long time in the making for UC, but there's the argument that it's biased and does not adequately reflect students' ability to excel. Tell us more about this idea, which is really an argument about standardized testing as a whole.
Right. There's been a longstanding view that the tests hold back minority students. Black and Latino students do not do as well on the test on average as white and Asian students. And this is regardless of the test. And many people believe that that is because of the nature of the tests. Now, what UC is doing is they're going to go test optional for 2 years, which means students can decide whether to submit or not, then test blind for 2 years, which means no tests will be used in admissions, and then in the fifth year, they hope to create a new test.
I know that the ACT has actually said that they don't believe that the test is biased, that it's more about longstanding educational inequalities that happened prior to students taking the test. An ACT chief executive told the UC Regents in a letter that suspending this test requirement would actually exacerbate students' anxieties, strain admissions offices, and squeeze state and school budgets. Is that true? And if so, how so?
I'm not sure it's totally true. Look, up until now, the SAT has been a crucial, and the ACT have been crucial parts of admissions. So students have spent a ton of time getting ready for them. And so obviously with this change, all of a sudden they have something different to think about, you know, whether they want to submit SAT scores. On the other hand, while this is not brought about because of coronavirus, it's in the middle of it, which means students, one, couldn't take the SAT this spring or the ACT and need to figure out, you know, what they want to do. So, yes, students are under stress, but I'm not sure it's really because of this decision.
More than 1,000 colleges and universities have already dropped SAT or ACT tests. I'm thinking about what impact this will have beyond the UCs. Is this a measure you can see even more universities making now in order to compete for students?
Yes, because, look, UC is much more prestigious than are most of the colleges that have gone test optional. And so and American higher education is very much follow the leaders. And UC includes Berkeley and UCLA, which are two of the top public universities in the country or the world. And what they do matters a lot. And so, yes, it's going to have an influence.
And you mentioned
how much time students take on preparing for this test. I'm thinking about the larger economy that's been built around these tests, from the books to the tutors to the classes. Mm-hmm. What happens to that industry?
That industry undergoes a huge change. First of all, right now, while it's test optional, it continues to push the SAT and the ACT. But if a new test indeed comes into existence, because California is a large state, that industry refocuses on the UC test. But that's a big if on whether that happens or not.
Yeah. So for now, this program is a pilot. The UCs are trying this out for 5 years. What will be some of the markers of success they're looking for? And what can we expect to happen next, do you think?
Well, what happens next is they do a study on whether they can do their own test. And you know, that's a key issue. Markers of success would be, do they get more diverse students into the UC system? They have complained that not enough Black and Latino students get in. Do more students get in, and do they do well? That's a key for it.
Yeah. So really, they'll be measuring over the next 5 years to see if there will actually be more students who get in. And
well, no. Over the next 5 years, they're not doing the new test.
Right,
they're
right. That's what I mean.
New test, so they won't really have anything to measure.
So it's really, we will see what comes of these decisions. We're talking about over the next decade to two decades to come.
Yes, definitely.
That's Scott Jasek. He is editor and co-founder of Inside Higher Ed. Thank you so much, Scott.
Thanks so much.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.